Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning, welcome to class. We have a few classes left, and this is Bio 241. The date is May 7th. We're going to finish up respiratory chapter and probably move into renal physiology today. That gives us a little head start for next week. We're going to start renal physiology next week, and I just got confused, so let's look and see how many weeks we have before the next test.
All right. Yeah, I thought it was one, but we have two. That's marvelous. All right, so May 7th to the 14th is one, 14th to the 21st is two. So we've got 2 weeks left, exactly 2 weeks is your last test. 14, 16, 17, and 20. I'm working on a list of questions for 20, but the figure pretty much is already defined for you, and the figure number is 20.33. 20.33, which is the hormone profiles during the ovulatory and uterine cycles. Mm-hmm. Okay, that is really nice. All right, does anybody have a question regarding the schedule before I switch it off? No questions on schedule? Fantastic. All right, well, you notice that I'm wearing a tie today. I don't hardly ever wear a tie because I'm going to graduation ceremonies here at Cypress College. All right, Puente program is graduating their scholars tonight, so I'm going to go. I don't know if you know anybody in the Puente program, so be sure to congratulate them if you know them and see them for graduating. Okay, so I won't wear this sash right now, though. That's okay. It's really pretty. It's really pretty. I'll wear it during the graduation ceremonies on the Friday at the end of the semester for sure. Okay, so we were looking at respiratory chapter last time, and let's review some things. There's a very important enzyme that can convert a compound that's very important in cellular respiration. Okay, and that compound is actually the most sensitive chemical that regulates respiration. Okay, let's get this going like that. Slideshow mode, yeah, you're welcome. Okay, let's even get the pointer option. That's what happens sometimes when I think too hard. I don't pay attention to what's going on. Okay, so there's a compound in our body that is the most sensitive chemical for regulating respiration. Okay, and what is that chemical? This is kind of a hint to the name of the enzyme that I'm interested in learning about from you guys. Yeah, so we have choices would be oxygen, CO2, and pH, and your answer would be CO2. And it just so happens that there's an enzyme that can adjust the levels of CO2 by converting it into something else very rapidly. And I want to know the name of that enzyme and what can CO2 be converted into. Yeah, it's that. You guys are really hot. You're on the right track. It's coming back to you. It is? Bicarbonate is what it can be converted into via the carbonic anhydrase reaction. All right, so carbonic anhydrase can take CO2 and water, make carbonic acid out of it, which doesn't stay carbonic acid very long. It gets converted to a hydrogen ion and bicarbonate. That's the bicarbonate buffer system, and we have carbonic anhydrase in very many places in our body. So CO2 is tightly regulated, it's maintained at a constant level to maintain homeostasis. We looked at a couple respiratory structures that control respiration. They're in the medulla and the pons, right? In the brainstem, and there are three of them, and they're on this slide. This is just a quick review. I see one in the medulla, and I see two up in the pons, so these areas are basically all linked together. Rhythmicity center is the pacemaker, kind of like the SA node in your heart. And just as the pacemaker has two inputs, parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, antagonistic control over heart rate, there is sort of antagonistic control over respiration with the following two centers, apneustic area and pneumotaxic area. And so I want you to recall, what is the job of the apneustic area? How does it affect the rhythmicity center? That's right. It is excitatory on ventilation, so it increases the rate and depth of inspiration. That's its job. And then we should know what the pneumotaxic area is, which you could probably guess since you are very familiar with control systems now. Because what's the best way to control this rhythmicity center is with a gas pedal and a brake pedal through some kind of antagonistic mechanism, right? So the pneumotaxic area will inhibit the apneustic area, and that will allow for expiration. Okay. And as a matter of fact, if something happens to the pneumotaxic area, the apneustic center takes over. And what does somebody experience when their apneustic center takes over? They have tremendous difficulty exhaling. They will always have the urgency to inhale. That's called apneusis, right? And I'm sure you can realize that that really would be a nuisance for that to happen. And as a matter of fact, if there's enough damage to the medulla and the pons, then maybe all kinds of automatic breathing would stop, so that the only time you can inspire is when you physically will that diaphragm to contract, like your biceps muscle. Right, and when you're sleeping, what happens to your biceps muscle? Nothing. It just sits there, right? And the same thing would happen to your diaphragm, and then of course you would just suffocate if that were to happen. So when somebody has this particular disease, then they have to be on a respirator when they're sleeping. Otherwise, they would die. And then this is what I'm trying to get to. What's the name of that disease? It's called Odin's Curse. Odin's Curse. Odin's Curse. Right. Okay. All right, you know where the chemoreceptors are located, aortic arch and carotid sinus. Make sure you know where that carotid sinus is. Did anybody learn where the carotid sinus was in an anatomy class? Raise your hand real quick if you learned about it in anatomy. Not everybody, but it's really important to know where that structure is, right?
And,
yeah, that's right, where the common carotid bifurcates into the internal and external carotid artery. And it's a place where there's a lot of disease in a blood vessel. It's almost one of the first places where cardiovascular disease shows up. All right, so here is that carbonic anhydrase reaction. Talked about that. Here's what I wanted to look at. I did want to go over the slide really quick. All right, here we have chemoreceptors. All right, and here I see cerebral spinal fluid. So what kind of chemoreceptors are these? This is good. It's not labeled on the slide. What kind of chemoreceptors are these? There are two categories of chemoreceptors. There are peripheral receptors and central receptors. Which ones are these?
Central.
Yeah, these are central because, you know, this is central nervous system because why? Here is cerebrospinal fluid. All right, so these chemoreceptors are very sensitive to changes in pH or changes in hydrogen ion concentration. But if there's a high hydrogen ion concentration in this blood, which means what in terms of pH? High hydrogen is low pH, right? So if there's a low pH, so don't get tricked when I say low pH, it really means what? An increase in acidity. So if there is a low pH, these hydrogen ions can't move across the blood-brain barrier into the brain, and these chemoreceptors can't sense what the pH of the blood is. Right, because it's an ion. Ions have difficulty, as you know, going across cell membranes. Right, so how does the brain get information about pH inside your body? Yeah, so CO2 can diffuse through the blood-brain barrier, and when CO2 is in the cerebral spinal fluid, there's an enzyme which is called carbonic anhydrase, which produces bicarbonate and hydrogen ions, and those hydrogen ions then can stimulate the chemoreceptors or the central chemoreceptors in the medulla oblongata. Okay. All right, and here's a graph that just shows you that carbon dioxide is the chemical that produces the greatest changes in ventilation when there are small changes in concentration. Right, if there are small changes in oxygen concentration, there is no effect on ventilation, but if there are small changes in CO2 concentration, there are large changes in ventilation. So that's a pretty important graph. Who knows something about the herring brewer reflex? What does it do?
Keeps the lungs from over.
Yeah, it's an inhibitory reflex, right? And it just prevents overinflation of the lungs because lungs are very delicate tissue. Herring-Brewer reflex, it prevents overinflation of the lungs. overinflation. So it inhibits inspiration, okay, at the top of a tidal volume. Okay, what's the best way to talk about concentration of oxygen in an artery? PO2. I like PO2, but I would like to have a number as well. What is the PO2 in an artery typically? Okay, PO2? Oh, you guys are giving me some numbers. You should know something about 40. I heard 100. Okay, and I'm showing you the graph right here at the moment, so you can actually just read the answer off this graph. Right, so basically 100% saturated in arteries and, I'm sorry, 100 millimeters of mercury in arteries and 40 millimeters of mercury in veins, and that's at rest, right? So the partial pressure of oxygen is sort of like the concentration of oxygen inside the blood. That's one way that you could think about that. Okay, and the difference between those two points shows you how much oxygen is delivered to tissues. And so we see that as the partial pressure of oxygen increases, there's a direct relationship to saturation of hemoglobin, right? So as the oxygen concentration or partial pressure increases, more hemoglobin is saturated with oxygen. That makes perfect sense. All right, so we look at this oxygen saturation curve in the conditions of pH. We change the pH. So what's a normal pH in blood? 7.4 is pretty normal, right? That's right at the high end of the range, but we'll say that's normal. And we can change the pH and measure the percent oxygen saturation by changing the partial pressure of oxygen and making our measurements, right? And which way does the curve shift when the pH is reduced, when the solution becomes more acidic? Which way does it, where does it shift? Yeah, to the right. It's a right shift. But you should also have a good handle. What does that mean when the saturation curve shifts to the right in terms of oxygen delivery? Okay. It decreases affinity. And when that happens, I guess we have to analyze these curves right here. Let's look at a normal condition. And what's the PO2 in an artery? 100, right? And at 100... we have basically 100% saturation in hemoglobin for this normal curve. And what's the saturation when the pH is 7.2? It's almost 100 as well, a little bit less, right? But almost exactly the same. Now let's go to the venous end. Where should we start looking for venous PO2? What was that ballpark number? 40. So let's go all the way here. Here's 40. And now let's go up and take a look at those two curves. Right. Which one has the lower percent saturation? Okay. Is it the seven? Is it the acidic condition or normal pH? Acidic condition. All right. So they both started basically at the same percent saturation, but as the blood becomes acidic, we see that the saturation of oxygen decreases. So what can you tell me about unloading of oxygen to tissues? Okay. Yeah, it increases by this amount. It increases from, 60 to, 75, right, a 15% change in oxygen saturation. So that difference is what's delivered to the tissues. So basically what I want you to see is when there's a right shift, what happens to oxygen delivery to tissues when there's a right shift? Does it increase or decrease? There is an increase oxygen delivery to tissues when there is an acidic change. And I think that makes perfect sense because when you exercise a muscle, what metabolite do you need to keep that muscle exercising, contracting? You need oxygen, absolutely, right, to feed those mitochondria to make ATP. And when a muscle contracts, it does produce some anaerobic metabolism. And what's the end product of anaerobic metabolism would be? Lactic acid. So when a muscle exercises, it does become more acidic. That shifts the oxygen saturation curve to the right, which helps unloading of oxygen to the tissues, which is what you would like to have happen, right? So does that make sense to you? Okay. All right, we're going to look at a couple other circumstances that shift a curve to the right. All right, so we said a decrease in pH. What the heck is that? A decrease in pH is an increase in acidity, right? Decreases the affinity of oxygen for hemoglobin, so that shifts the curve to the right. And what does that do for oxygen delivery in the tissues? It increases oxygen delivery. This is what we call the Bohr effect. Bohr effect is when there's an increased oxygen delivery to tissues, right, when there is a pH shift, but only a pH shift. All right, let's look at temperature. Let's increase temperature. When we increase temperature, there is a decrease in affinity of oxygen. And so what does that do to the curve? It shifts it to the right. And when there's a right shift, what happens to oxygen delivery in tissues? Yeah, it increases. When would a muscle experience an increase in temperature? When it's exercising, sure. And would it be good to have more oxygen on board when that muscle is exercising? Yeah, absolutely. So this right shift helps maintain the proper muscle physiology, right, by delivering more oxygen. So it increases oxygen unloading during exercise. All right, and then here's something we didn't talk about yet, 2,3-DPG. This is a molecule that has three carbons, and this 2 and 3 right here just means that there's a phosphate group at these two locations on the molecule, right? So the DP stands for diphosphoglycerate. This is a metabolite of glycolysis, so it's a very common kind of metabolite. And when there's an increase of 2,3-DPG in a red blood cell, that decreases the affinity of oxygen of red blood cells. That shifts the curve to the right, which then enhances oxygen unloading. All right, so let's take a look at the mechanism involved with 2,3-DPG. All right, so here we see a nice red blood cell. And when the partial pressure of oxygen decreases for whatever reason, and a really good reason that happens all the time, when somebody goes up in the mountains, goes up in altitude, the partial pressure of all gases decreases in the atmosphere, including oxygen. Maybe some of you have gone up in the mountains and experienced shortness of breath or dizziness or whatever. That's just because there's less oxygen at that altitude. All right, so at high altitude, there's less oxyhemoglobin because there's less oxygen in the air. And when there's less oxyhemoglobin, there is less inhibition of the production of this compound, 2,3-DPG. So if there's less inhibition, what happens to the concentration of 2,3-DPG? It increases, right? So at high altitude, there's an increase, 2,3-DPG, that lowers the affinity of oxygen to hemoglobin, which is what kind of shift? Right shift. Oh, too bad I modified the slide, but maybe you would know that already, right? A right shift, which does what? That increases unloading of oxygen to tissues. And what was the initial stimulus? Yeah, low delivery of oxygen to tissues because of that high altitude, the low partial pressure. So that does what? Add or subtract from the stimulus? Yeah, it subtracts from the stimulus. So here is a nice negative feedback mechanism that maintains homeostasis, right, in terms of oxygen delivery to tissues. So what we see on this table is an increase in 2,3-DPG causes a right shift that increases oxygen unloading in tissues. And this is what happens when the partial pressure of oxygen decreases in the air that we're breathing. And when would the partial pressure of oxygen decrease in the air that we're breathing? Okay. What would cause a decrease in the partial pressure of oxygen in air that we're breathing? That we're breathing in and out. That is when you start to go up in altitude, higher and higher and higher altitude. Okay, like driving up in the mountains, for instance, would be a good example. Or if somebody lived up in the mountains, right, they would have an increased 2,3-DPG level in their red blood cells, and that would help oxygen delivery. I don't know how fast this mechanism can take place, but I think probably maybe within a day it can be significant. So if you go up in the mountains, you might feel some respiratory distress, you might feel out of breath, and then after a day, you probably start to feel more normal, right? And so this is a pretty fast mechanism. Not as fast as pH and temperature, because it takes a little while for this metabolite to increase in red blood cells. Yeah, it stays in the red blood cell, and it doesn't do anybody any good. It just stays in that red blood cell, doesn't get out to the tissues. Yeah, it gets trapped in that red blood cell. So here is a really nice picture of a red blood cell, right? Biconcave, nice and it's like a disc, flat and smooth. Well, I was going to ask you that. What's the surface look like? Is it all rough and jagged or is it smooth? Why do you think it's smooth? Why should it be smooth? Yeah, it's got to slide through and over blood vessels and over the endocardium in the heart. And some capillaries are so small that only one red blood cell can get through there at a time. Right, so it's got to be able to slip through very small vessels. And so that just prevents blood clots from forming. Here is a condition. Now, what can you tell me about the shape of these red blood cells? Almost the same red blood cells as over here. Are they the same shape? They are not. What happens to physiology when they change shape like that? It changes. Absolutely, it changes. So now these red blood cells, because they have all these pointy ends on them, they have severe difficulty moving through small blood vessels, especially capillaries, but probably arterioles as well, small arterioles. They get trapped. And then what happens to oxygen delivery to those tissues? It decreases. Yeah, it's like having a stroke almost. All right, so these cells are what we call sickle cells, and they are loaded with an abnormal form of hemoglobin. And as a result, right, that abnormal form of hemoglobin changes the shape of the cell because hemoglobin stacks a little bit differently inside these cells, changes the shape of the cell so that they don't flow through capillaries. And what's the function of a capillary? Exchange. And so exchange in those tissues, right, is greatly reduced. Okay, and since this happens everywhere in the cardiovascular system, what capillaries are affected? What place in the body is affected by this sickle cell condition? Every capillary, that's right. Everywhere in the body, there are flow restrictions. So what happens when you restrict blood flow to, let's say, a muscle? Okay, yeah, it dies. But in the meantime, have you ever had a spasm in a muscle in some part of your body? How does that feel when you have a muscle spasm? When you have a muscle spasm, blood can't get into that muscle because it just turned into a solid mass, right? And it's producing a lot of lactic acid, right? And so what does that feel like?
Terrible.
Hurts like hell, right? Okay, when somebody is in sickle cell crisis and that happens to their capillaries everywhere in their body, guess how they feel? It hurts like hell everywhere, all right? So this is kind of a really unfortunate, sad condition. And here is another group of patients that you might see repeatedly, and they will come in very extreme pain. And what do we provide for patients in extreme pain? Yeah, pain medication, right? So you don't ever treat somebody with sickle cell anemia as a drug seeker or a drug abuser, right? Because they need that medication just to feel normal once again, right? Okay. All right, so that's something about sickle cell anemia. We just got done talking about oxygen transport, and we got to finish up talking about CO2 transport. CO2 is a lot more soluble in water, so CO2 doesn't necessarily have to bind to hemoglobin to be transported. And so here we have some tissue cells that are producing CO2, right? So they are respiring. If it's a muscle cell, they're contracting. And that CO2 then diffuses into the blood via some kind of capillary. And how is it transported? Well, it's transported a little bit as CO2. Some CO2 can dissolve in plasma, 10%. Does anybody know what it was for oxygen? It was really close to zero, right? It was very, very little, maybe a couple percent. All right. But for CO2, some actually can dissolve in plasma and be transported. CO2 can also diffuse into this red blood cell, and it can combine with hemoglobin to form carbaminohemoglobin. And about 20% of the CO2 your body produces is transported that way. And fortunately, that doesn't really inhibit the binding of oxygen to hemoglobin, so they both can be carried at the same time. So CO2 is not a poison in that sense, not like carbon monoxide. All right, and then CO2, when it enters a red blood cell, the red blood cell has carbonic anhydrase. And what does that do? It combines CO2 and water to produce carbonic acid, which dissociates almost immediately into hydrogen ion and bicarbonate, and bicarbonate is a salt of this reaction, and just think of a salt, table salt. How much table salt dissolves in water? Can any dissolve in water? Say you have a glass of water and some table salt, you pour it in there, stir it up with a spoon, what happens to that salt? Does any of it go into solution? Yeah, like what? Almost all of it, right? Okay, so there is high solubility in these red blood cells and also in plasma outside red blood cells for bicarbonate. So one way CO2 is transported in the blood as the bicarbonate ion, is in the form of bicarbonate. Okay, and as a matter of fact, there's so much bicarbonate that can be produced in this red blood cell that it will diffuse out of the red blood cell. And remember, bicarbonate is an ion. What kind of an ion does this look like to you? It's an anion, right? And that would change the electrical properties of this red blood cell, but in real life that does not happen. So if there's an anion that leaves, what has to happen? Another anion has to enter the red blood cell, right? So, and that is a chloride. So we call that the chloride shift. So there is a chloride shift that balances out the electrical potential across the membrane when bicarbonate leaves, because we don't want to change the membrane potential of this cell. All right, so how is most of the carbon dioxide transported in your body? As the
bicarbonate ion.
Yeah, as bicarbonate, that's right. All right, so this is in tissues. And where is this blood going to go after a systemic capillary? There's going to be another place where exchange happens. Where's another place in your body where exchange happens besides systemic capillaries? Kidney capillaries, you know, are systemic capillaries. They're part of the systemic circulation. I heard pulmonary circulation. I like that, right? So you got systemic circulation, pulmonary circulation. All right, so now we have this bicarbonate and these red blood cells in another capillary, but in the pulmonary circulation. All right, so now we're in the lungs. So what do you think happens to CO2 in the lungs? Yeah, it gets exhaled, right? So how does that happen? Well, here's an alveolus, and as we inspire air, you can go back and look at this, the percentage of CO2 or the partial pressure of CO2 in air, right? And it's what? Almost zero. It's really, really close to zero. And CO2 in blood is a lot higher, so CO2 will diffuse from plasma into the alveolus, right? Because the concentration gradient drives that. CO2 that's bound to hemoglobin dissociates, right? And now this CO2 goes into plasma and into the alveolus because that's the lowest concentration. And since now CO2 is being removed from red blood cells and plasma, here is that carbonic anhydrase reaction, right? And what happens to a carbonic anhydrase reaction when CO2 starts to disappear? These compounds like to move around. How do they move around? What would be a law to describe what's going to happen here? It's the law of mass action. Okay. So if we remove CO2, carbonic anhydrase reaction is going to try to replenish that CO2 by taking bicarbonate and hydrogen ions, making carbonic acid that will dissociate to CO2. Right? That's the law of mass action because there's no difference, there's no delta G. For this reaction, right? So this reaction can go back and forth. As a matter of fact, on your slide, you should probably make this a double-ended arrow and maybe make it a little one, because under these conditions, the reaction is favored going to the left under these conditions. All right, so CO2 or bicarbonate is taken out of your body, it's converted into CO2, and we exhale it. So the carbonic anhydrase reaction is so important for regulating CO2 in our body, and also since it affects hydrogen ion, it also helps regulate pH in our body. All right, so if somebody is hyperventilating and getting rid of a lot of CO2, what else is happening? Okay, what else, what is necessary to make this CO2 that you're exhaling? Hydrogen ions, so you are breathing basically acid outside of your body. And if somebody is hyperventilating, they can go into a state that we call respiratory alkalosis, right? Their body can actually become too basic. So you guys probably didn't know you're such aliens in your basic nature that we exhale all of this acid right out of our body with our ventilation. Okay, so this is what we call the reversed chloride shift, right? When bicarbonate enters the cell, way down over here someplace, very left side. When bicarbonate enters the cell, that chloride has to, go back into the plasma. We call that the reverse chloride shift to maintain the electrical neutrality or the proper membrane potential on this red blood cell. Okay, so that's it for respiratory chapter. Do we have any questions? Reversed chloride shift. So you get a chloride shift in tissues, you get a reverse chloride shift in lungs. And that's because bicarbonate is going to move in and out of the cell as a result. Okay. Okay, well, I guess I could say just a quick thing about sickle cell anemia. This is due to the simplest kind of mutation in a gene. It's called a point mutation. One base pair gets changed, and that changes the whole structure of the hemoglobin molecule to produce this disease. So that, again, kind of underscores a very small change in structure of a molecule can cause huge, major changes in physiology, right? A point mutation can basically change a red blood cell that can flow through capillaries into red blood cells that get stuck in capillaries, right? Yeah.
Is it like people with sickle cell anemia or whatever, they can't like catch a malaria?
Oh, so you might be wondering, there are evolutionary processes that select against diseases in humans, right? And this particular disease right here is sort of selected for the following reason. Even though these sickle cells have problem moving through blood vessels, that mutation protects people from malaria. All right, and so there is a protective effect of that mutation, but also a deleterious effect of that mutation. And there are actually two genes associated with it because we have pairs of chromosomes inside our body, okay? And that sickle cell trait, you can have just one gene or both genes. Sometimes we call those alleles. If you have just one allele, we call that heterozygous. A person is protected from malaria. But if you have both alleles with the sickle cell trait, then it can be expressed. And so that person is protected from malaria, but they're much more susceptible to the sickle cell crisis, right? So you might be a carrier for that particular gene. Okay. All right, so let's go on to urinary system. So what organ are we going to be interested in when we think about the urinary system? Yeah, the kidneys primarily. The gross anatomy of the urinary system is really simple, super simple. So probably I'll just say what it is. Maybe there's a slide in here, I'm not sure. But it is so absolutely simple. Oh yeah, here it is. There's only four structures that make up the urinary system. You got kidneys, you have a urinary bladder, and then the connection between the two is a ureter, and then you have a tube from the urinary bladder to the outside world called the urethra. All right, so those are the only four structures. Kidneys have to be producing urine all the time. If they stop producing urine, then they're going to fail, which means they're going to die. And so we produce urine every second of our life, but we do not lose urine. We do not urinate every second because what happens to that urine that the kidneys are producing? It's stored in the urinary bladder until there's a proper time to void. Right? So void is a good term to use for that. And you're just going to have to go back to anatomy and review what all these different structures are. Right here are the renal pyramids. And I think right now you should probably know what makes up these renal pyramids. What is the functional unit that is contained within these pyramids? It is the structure that produces urine. And I heard it, some people know, it's the nephron, right? So what's the structural functional unit of contraction? Sarcomere, what's the structural functional unit of communication between cells? You're really close. I hear a lot of swishing going around. It is a synapse, right? So if you know how one synapse works, you have a really good idea how all work. What about the structural functional unit of life? That's a cell. Yeah. Okay, and the structural functional unit of urine formation is the nephron, right? Okay, so here I see part of a nephron, and I'm not going to go over any of this gross anatomy, not because it's gross, but because this is not an anatomy class. All right, so what is the structural and functional unit of urine formation? Nice, you guys know that. Okay. I'm going to come back to this slide in a second. Okay, a nephron has all the tubes within a nephron can be grouped into two categories. The first category is a tubular element. The second category is a vascular element. What is contained in a vascular element? Blood. Yeah, you should just say blood in a vascular, right? Part of the cardiovascular system. And some of these are arterioles, some are capillaries, some are venules. And here is something with a really strange name. It's called the glomerulus. And the glomerulus is really a special kind of capillary. So that means what's happening in the glomerulus? Exchange. That's right. And this capillary is very leaky. It's fenestrated. Remember, there are different kinds of capillaries. Some are more leaky than others. A fenestrated capillary is pretty leaky. All right, so a lot of things leak out of the glomerulus into a tubular element. All right, furthermore, we see that the glomerulus is a capillary. That blood goes into an arteriole and then into another capillary. What kind of circulatory pattern is that called? When blood has to go through two capillaries before it goes back to the heart. The typical circulation is heart, capillary, then back to the heart. Heart, artery, capillary, vein, back to the heart. But here is what? Heart, artery, capillary, another blood vessel, second capillary, then vein, back to the heart. What do we call that kind of circulatory pattern? Yeah, that's a portal system, right? And there aren't many in our body, so it would be nice if you could appreciate this as a really special door-to-door delivery system created by this portal system. And the efferent arteriole is really the portal blood vessel. But the other thing that is important by noticing that the efferent arteriole is a portal blood vessel is that arterioles can have a special function inside our body. Capillaries are there for exchange, and arterioles can vasoconstrict and vasodilate. And when a blood vessel vasodilates, what happens to blood flow through it? When it dilates, increases. Right? When it constricts, it decreases. And what can you tell me about that dilation and constriction when there is a small change in radius of that particular vessel, these arterioles? There is a huge change in blood flow, right? And you should know the law, right? It goes to the fourth power of the radius. What is that law called? Yeah, you probably have to listen to it. I don't have it online for you guys to listen to, but it's Poiseuille's law, right? Poiseuille's equation. Okay, so this portal blood vessel is pretty important because it can help regulate blood flow through the nephron. Okay, all right, so vascular elements, tubular elements, got to be familiar with all of these. I'm sure all of you are, but if I have a marker, let's draw it on the board. And you should be able to draw this out probably in about a minute. All right, if you're really on top of your game and you're really going to follow our discussion. Okay. All right, so here is an illustration on the PowerPoint slide of a nephron, and I think it has all of the components. You have your two slides that have the tubular elements and vascular elements in front of you. And so I want to draw a nephron out, and I want to draw it by the category of these different elements. So let's see. Let's start with the tubular elements. All right, tubular elements first. So what's the first tubular element that you have? Bowman's capsule right here. And then you have something that looks like this. All right, so I'm going to label this BC. Here is the PCT. And then you got that and that. All right, so here is the descending loop of Henle, and then the ascending loop of Henle. Sorry, that's an A right there. And then you got some more squiggles up over here, which is the distal convoluted tubule, and then that goes into a collecting duct. Some people don't include collecting duct as part of the nephron, but it really is But there can just be many of these nephrons connected to one collecting duct. All right, so that's okay if you see that. All right, so what kind of elements did I draw right here? Tubular elements, and what's contained in a tubular element? Okay. Hint, it's not blood. And you name it after the process that happens here in Bowman's capsule. Indeed. The fluid in here is called filtrate. Right, so here we have filtrate. And what's important for you to see there is that if there's a chemical in filtrate, where does it end up? In your body or outside your body? Outside your body. That becomes urine, right? Oh, I'm sorry. Let's put that down here. Just for fun, we got urine, right, at the end of the collecting duct. Okay, so we got filtrate. This is all filtrate. Let's do, what's the other component we want to work with? Oh, wow. What's this marker? Fancy. Do we have, we got a little bit in there. Okay, so let's do vascular elements now. You know your list of vascular elements. Here is a blood vessel that's bringing blood to a capillary. This is an arteriole. But which kind of arteriole? This is the afferent arteriole that brings blood into Bowman's capsule, and there is that special leaky capillary, right, the fenestrated capillary, which we call the, probably nobody will be able to leave today if you can't say glomerulus, right? It's not really difficult, glomerulus. What kind of blood vessel is the glomerulus? It's a capillary specialized for exchange. Normally, then, this would go into a vein back to the heart, but in the nephron, it does not. It goes into another arteriole, which means that can vasoconstrict, vasodilate. The second arteriole is called the efferent arteriole. And what kind of blood vessel does an arteriole bring blood to? Okay, what kind of blood vessel does the afferent arteriole bring blood to? It is a capillary. Yeah, so we got to draw one more capillary in here. The next capillary surrounds all of these tubular elements. All right, so I don't know how I want to draw that. I'll just kind of flow, let it go like that, right? So blood is flowing through all of these different places. And since this blood vessel surrounds all of these tubular elements, we call this the peritubular capillary. Peritubular capillary. All right, and you know that's for exchange, right? And then that goes into some venule and then back to the heart. Okay, so eventually you're going to have to draw some arrows in here because we said exchange is happening, so you should know what kind of exchange is happening, which way it's going. All right, so if there is a compound in the peritubular capillary, where is it going to end up? In urine or your body? In your body. It's going to stay in your body, right? So if there's something in filtrate and it goes back into the blood, we call that resorption. That means it's going to stay in your body. If there's a chemical that's in this peritubular capillary and it ends up in filtrate, where is it going to go? Out of your body. We call that secretion. Okay. There's only one other process, but we'll review those a little bit. So you got to be able to draw that probably in less than a minute. You can use those abbreviations. And that's what we see on this PowerPoint slide. Right. So here is the nephron. So what's the best way to start breaking down a nephron into two components, which are tubular and vascular? And if anything's in a tubular element, it's going to be excreted from your body. All right? And if there's something in a tubular element that your body wants, right, your body sometimes can put it back in the blood. We call that resorption. And it will stay in your body. Okay, so that's the nephron. Okay, here's a pretty fancy diagram, better than I drew, of the glomerulus inside Bowman's capsule. So we actually see a couple layers of Bowman's capsule right here. Kind of a fancy structure. Okay, proximal convoluted tubule. Can you picture where that is? What's it next to? It's right next to the Bowman's capsule, right next to Bowman's capsule. All right, the walls of the proximal convoluted tubule are just a simple cuboidal epithelium, and it has microvilli. And what's the function of microvilli? Yeah, it increases the surface area of those cells, which enhances absorption. And so that's really important. So things are going to move from the filtrate back into the blood because, or these microvilli will enhance that. So when I say increased surface area, what should you really think of? You should think of, yeah, microvilli would be the structure, okay, but in, like in an everyday structure that you use all the time. When I say surface area, oh, you guys are going to be scarred for life if you can think this.
Oh,
it is a doorway. That's right, a doorway. So every time you walk through a doorway between now and the final, you're going to think, ah, surface area. I'm being exchanged. I'm walking through something, right? Okay. That's because these cells have microvilli. And here, and it just says, increases surface area for resorption. That's the proper spelling for resorption. And what the heck is resorption? Resorption is when a compound goes from filtrate back into the blood. And maybe I'll just draw it in. So we got a compound that's in a tubular element, right? And it goes back into the blood. We call that resorption. That's actually going to be process number two that we're going to be looking at. Okay, so during resorption, salt water and other molecules that are needed by the body are transported through the lumen of this tube, which is pretty simple, just a simple cuboidal epithelium, and back into the peritubular capillaries. Where do you find peritubular capillaries? All around those tubular elements. And, okay, how does that happen? I'm going to, I don't know why that slide is right there, but I think you had to, here was an exam figure I think you had to draw. Here I see a cuboidal type cell, and I can see some microvilli on there. And so the microvilli are pointing into the lumen of a kidney tubule. So what kind of fluid is in this lumen of a kidney tubule? What kind of material? Yeah, filtrate. Okay, and where would those compounds go if it stays in filtrate? It'll be excreted from your body. Yeah, it's going to be put in urine. Okay, so here we have filtrate in a kidney tubule. We got the simple cuboidal epithelium. Here we have a little interstitial space and then a nice capillary specialized for exchange. So there are things in filtrate that your body does not want to lose. One of those things is glucose, right? And you know how important glucose is. What can your body make with glucose? You don't tell me starch or glycogen. Yes, it can, but basically ATP, right, through glycolysis and cellular respiration. So that's a very important energy molecule. In your car, that important energy molecule would be gasoline in most cases, all right? So your body doesn't want to lose any molecule of glucose whatsoever, all right? So the concentration of glucose in the filtrate is going to become very low, while the concentration of glucose inside your body is going to be relatively high. What do we call that process going from low to high? That's active transport, right? So it's going to take some energy to get glucose out of the filtrate and put back in your body, and there are just a limited number of transporters that can do that. So if there is so much glucose in the blood that it saturates all these transporters, then what happens to this glucose that can't get transported back into the body? Yeah, it gets excreted, stays in urine, and you know that condition to be called, two words, diabetes mellitus, right? When glucose is so high in filtrate, which means it was so high in the glomerulus or this afferent arteriole. All right, so how does this glucose go from a low concentration to high? There's also sodium. We want to be able to resorb sodium. That's so important in our bodies. Okay, so here is a mechanism that can transport glucose in. So sodium is at a high concentration where? Inside the cell or outside? You guys should know that, outside the cell, right, including filtrate. So it's low inside the cell, so which way does sodium want to go? It wants to go high to low from the filtrate into the cell. It wants to rush right in. And in a what is really a gradient? What's one good way to think a gradient of something, a gradient of electrons? It's an energy source, right? Any kind of gradient is an energy source. Like if you walk up a hill, what can you do? You can roll down a hill, right? So, and that energy allows you to do work. So here is that gradient of sodium, and because of this fancy protein in the membrane, it's a symporter or a co-transporter. It can allow sodium to enter the cell going down its concentration gradient, and when that happens, it drags along a glucose molecule, which goes from low concentration to high concentration. Okay? And so what kind of transport is co-transport? Is it active or passive? Passive. I don't see ATP right here. This is true. So I can see why you might get tricked on that. But I know you know that it is not passive transport.
Secondary active transport?
It is secondary active transport, right? So there's no ATP, so it's not primary active transport, but it is secondary active transport. So now we have sodium and glucose inside of this tubule cell. And now we have high glucose inside the cell, low glucose inside the blood because your liver is taking glucose, making glycogen out of it, muscles are taking this glucose and contracting, right? So glucose concentration in a normal individual is relatively low. And so here we have glucose high concentration inside the cell, low inside the blood. Which way will it want to diffuse? From the cell into the blood, right? Down its concentration. That's just simple diffusion. Glucose can't get across the cell membrane because it's a polar compound, right? Polar compounds can't get through the membrane. But here, I see it is. How is it possible for this glucose molecule to move across the basolateral membrane of this particular cell? Yeah, here is a special protein. And this is what we call facilitated diffusion. Right, so glucose can go from high to low as long as this facilitator is in the membrane. Okay, well, we're almost done. Also in the basolateral membrane, we have something you're really familiar with, and I see ATP being used. And I see molecules being transported across the membrane. So what is happening here? ATP is being used. What's happening here? Okay, this is primary active transport, and this is just your sodium potassium pump. So as sodium moves into the cell from the filtrate, right, it's pumped out of the cell to this interstitial space. So now sodium has done what? Just like glucose. It's gone from the filtrate back into the blood, but at the expense of ATP, right? And potassium also enters the cell because this is that special sodium potassium pump. So this is how sodium and glucose get resorbed. And what is resorption going from? Filtrate to blood. And as a matter of fact, on this slide, you might just want to jot that down, right? Filtrate, blood. And just draw one big arrow across. And what's the name of that process when something goes from filtrate to blood? Resorption. And as a matter of fact, if you want to say tubular reabsorption, that might even be better. Okay, because then you're thinking about a kidney tubule when you say it like that. Okay. All right, so now we can talk about some other things. Okay. All right. First process is going to happen between glomerulus and Bowman's capsule. So probably I want to draw a little arrow, a little dot on the glomerulus, which is what, a capillary, with an arrow pointing into Bowman's capsule. And I'm going to put a number one right there, and we're going to call that process something. You're going to have to tell me what that is. Right, the glomerulus is special. It's inside Bowman's capsule, but it has fenestrated capillaries, which are very leaky capillaries. They have fenestrations or large pores between the endothelial cells. And any kind of solute that is in plasma can pass through those fenestrations, except for huge proteins. Right? So these kind of capillaries could be about 400 times more permeable than continuous capillaries. So what do they look like? Maybe in anatomy you kind of looked at this. I'm not so sure. So let's go over it. Here's Bowman's capsule, right? Bowman's capsule, you should think of a serous membrane. Model that in your mind. How many divisions does a serous membrane have? Yeah, it's got three. Mucous membrane just has one, right? Serous membrane lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world. There is a visceral division of that membrane that lines the surface of the organ. So consider the glomerulus a special organ, and there's a membrane on top of it that is the visceral division of the glomerulus. And it's continuous, right? It just hops off the glomerulus and forms the wall of Bowman's capsule. And now this you should think of as the parietal division of that serous membrane. And what do you have between the visceral and parietal membranes? You have a serous fluid, or just think of a fluid, and then here is this fluid. Okay, here is the fluid. Notice that the visceral Bowman's capsule is also very leaky. It has these foot processes, but it has big spaces between these foot processes of the neighboring cells. I mean, it's still a simple squamous epithelium, but it's especially leaky because of what we call these filtration slits. So molecules can move through these filtration slits. It's hardly a barrier at all. And here is that fenestrated capillary. You can see all the fenestrations in it. That means that this capillary is especially leaky. Okay. So most things can move from a high pressure that's in the glomerulus to low pressure that's in this fluid. So this is filtrate inside Bowman's capsule. And material can move based on size. Like red blood cells can't get across because they are way too big. Small molecules, water, okay, can move across. Glucose can move across because it's a very, very small molecule. And I think you've performed a process like that, probably most of us have this morning, right? When have you had a solution of big particles and little particles and separated it into two solutions? One with just big particles and one with just the small particles. Somebody said, gave me a perfect example. When you made coffee, right? When you make coffee, you got water, really small molecule. You put coffee grounds in it, big pieces of particles. And then you mix it together and some of the coffee molecules dissolve into the water and you have coffee. And if you're French, you just like to eat it just like that. Okay, but what most of us do, separate it out, right? We get a piece of paper that we call a coffee filter, that's right, and we separate these particles out by their size, and so we end up with coffee grounds and then another material that we call filtrate. Yeah, so coffee is really filtrate, and it's produced by the process called filtration based on size. So this first process that happens in Bowman's capsule is what we call filtration. Okay, so number one is filtration. And which way do molecules go when they are filtered? Blood to filtrate or filtrate to blood? Blood to filtrate. Yeah, blood to filtrate. Okay, so the volume of filtrate is amazing, right? And the kidneys will filtrate a certain amount of material every minute. We call that the glomerular filtration rate. This is important for maintaining homeostasis in our body. And in women, it's about 115 milliliters per minute. Males, a little bit more, 125 milliliters per minute. And if you add all the minutes up in a day, that comes to 45 gallons, right? About 180 liters per day are filtered. That's a huge amount. I don't know how many gallons make up our body right now. That would be interesting to know. Our whole body is only probably a couple gallons. Yeah, it's only a couple gallons worth of fluid. Yeah, it's 5 liters. But even if I was to think of every water everywhere in your body, right, it's still probably less than 5 gallons. 45 gallons get filtered through the glomerulus. So we dehydrate very rapidly. So most of that filtered water has to go from the filtrate back into blood. And what do we call that process? Okay, that is number two. That is resorption. Otherwise, we would dehydrate. I calculated one time how fast we would dehydrate. It would just be a matter of minutes. Okay, so resorption. But I might be wrong on that because I can't remember what I calculated. All right, so most of the filtered water must be resorbed. Or death would ensue from water loss very, very quickly. Oh, and where would that water end up if it's not resorbed? In urine, yeah, it would be excreted, right? So you'd produce copious amounts of dilute urine if that were to happen. Okay, but it doesn't happen for a couple of reasons. Okay, it is regulated. The amount of blood that enters the glomerulus is regulated by two different ways. There's extrinsic control and intrinsic control. Intrinsic What's the intrinsic control mechanism in the heart called? Yeah, it is local. Intrinsic is local control, but it's a law. It's a law. It's the Frank Starling law of the heart, right? As the heart is presented more blood, it gets stronger, right? That, and doesn't require a nervous system to do that. There are intrinsic mechanisms for controlling glomerular filtration rate, and there are extrinsic. So we're going to talk about some of these things. Vasoconstriction or dilation of the afferent arterioles affects what? If we adjust, okay, dilation or constriction of this afferent arteriole, what are we really controlling? The amount of blood that's going to enter the glomerulus, right? So if there's vasoconstriction, that will decrease blood flow, that's going to decrease the filtration rate. If there's vasodilation, more blood will enter the glomerulus, that will increase the glomerular filtration rate. So how is this done? I think we're going to look at some extrinsic mechanisms first. So extrinsic means you need a nervous system or endocrine control system. And here we have the sympathetic nervous system. And sympathetic nervous system is outside the kidney, so this is extrinsic control. Sympathetic nerves help constrict the afferent arteriole. Right, and that helps maintain blood pressure, and it delivers more blood to the heart and muscles, and it takes some blood away from the kidneys. So let's take a look. If there's a decrease in blood pressure, there's a very rapid reflex that takes place. So if I say a very rapid reflex that maintains blood pressure, would you think of the renin angiotensin aldosterone mechanism? You're shaking your head no, because that's long term. Right, so that would be the baroreceptor reflex, short term. So there are baroreceptors, right? Pressure receptors in the arch and in the carotid sinus that sends information to the cardioregulatory center. And the cardioregulatory center is going to increase sympathetic tone or sympathetic activity, right? So we're talking about a decrease in blood pressure. Will increase sympathetic activity in the heart. What's the sympathetic effect on the heart? Increase what? Heart rate. What do we call that? Chronotropy. I like that. Is that the only thing effect it will have on the heart? It will help stroke. And how does that happen? Not through chronotropy. Inotropy, because sympathetic nerves will increase the force of contraction, right? So sympathetic nerve activity increases stroke volume and heart rate, both chronotropy and inotropy. And what's the effect on cardiac output? Yeah, both of those items are directly related to cardiac output, so cardiac output is going to go up. All right, sympathetic nerves also go to some blood vessels that cause vasoconstriction. What happens to resistance when you vasoconstrict a blood vessel? It increases, right. Now, what happens to blood pressure when you increase resistance in a blood vessel? You guys might have to derive that equation. What was that? Blood pressure is equal to, was it blood flow, blood pressure? I think a blood pressure is equal to what? Stroke volume times heart rate times PPR. All right, so if we increase resistance, what happens to blood pressure? It increases, right, because it's just directly related, right? Directly related to stroke volume and heart rate, but that's easy to see because that's just cardiac output. Okay, so total peripheral resistance increases because of that vasoconstriction in both arterioles in a lot of places in your body, but also the afferent arteriole. So when vasoconstriction happens in the afferent arteriole, right, that decreases blood flow to the glomerulus. Glomerular filtration goes down, okay, and since filtration goes down, urine production goes down. And if urine production goes down, where does all that water go? Okay, it stays in your body, right? You're not excreting it from your body. And so blood volume is increased when that happens. All right, and then we got to finish this thought off. What happens to your body when you have an increased blood volume? What happens to your heart? We just talked about it. What happens to your heart when you have increased blood volume? You have more blood flowing back to the heart. You have increased venous return because you have more volume. What happens to the heart then? the contractility increases, right? Inotropy increases, and the law that describes that is the Frank-Starling law of the heart, right? So this increased blood volume to get back up to here to subtract from a decreased blood pressure is what? The Frank-Starling law of the heart.
Where's the ADH in the
hospital? Yeah, they're in there, but that's for more longer term, okay? I think we get to talk about it a little bit. Oh, definitely we'll talk about it, okay? Okay. All right, so this is just extrinsic control due to the sympathetic nervous system for glomerular filtration. Okay. We still need to talk about intrinsic regulation. Sometimes we talk about this in the term of autoregulation. The kidneys can regulate themselves. There are two important mechanisms that will regulate glomerular filtration rate. And these mechanisms will try to maintain glomerular filtration rate at a constant level that maintains the health of the kidneys. Remember, they have to be producing urine all the time. And blood pressure in your body can go up and down. Blood pressure is going to change the glomerular filtration rate, but the kidney needs to have, and you almost need to have a constant glomerular filtration rate. So these mechanisms will maintain GFR even when blood pressure goes up and down. And these are intrinsic properties, something just inside the heart by itself. The first thing is called myogenic constriction, and the second one is called tubuloglomerular feedback. And we're going to talk about myogenic constriction first. Okay, you know where the afferent arteriole is? Bringing blood to the glomerulus. Okay, and as blood pressure increases, right, that's going to force a lot more blood into the glomerulus, which is going to increase glomerular filtration rate. But remember, we want to maintain constant GFR. So as blood pressure increases, what would have to happen to the afferent arteriole to maintain blood flow at a constant level through the glomerulus? It has to constrict. That's right. So there are stretch receptors in these smooth muscles, and as soon as blood pressure goes up, they start to stretch. The smooth muscles constrict to reduce that dilation. And that maintains blood flow through the glomerulus at a constant level, and that also then keeps glomerular filtration rate the same. So that leads us to talk about tubuloglomerular feedback. Well, there's a lot in that term. That sounds really complicated. What kind of tubes are we talking about? What kind of? Give me a name of a tube that we're talking about. Yeah, PCT, DCT, collecting duct, right? Some of these tubes. And you know where the glomerulus is, right? So there is some kind of feedback that's happening between these tubes, maybe the distal convoluted tubule and the glomerulus, to regulate filtration. All right, so here's a pretty good table, and it just shows, right, autoregulation or intrinsic control. When blood pressure goes up or blood pressure goes down, what happens to glomerular filtration? There's no change, right? So that's what we're aiming for, no change, a constant glomerular filtration rate. I guess I want to show you... Maybe I'll show you this a little bit later. I think I need to show you this right now. All right, so I'm moving ahead. Okay, this is a slide I need to see right now. Okay, so tubuloglomerular regulation. All right, so can you see anything that looks like a nephron where I'm circling with the cursor? Can you see something that looks like a nephron? Yeah, I see part of the nephron. I see Bowman's capsule. I see glomerulus, right? And I see the afferent, efferent arteriole. And then what I got? I got the PCT, loop of Henle. Here's the distal convoluted tubule. You see what happens to the distal convoluted tubule? Where does it go? It goes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole, where they're very close together, which is at the opening of the glomerulus right here. So this thing we call the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All these things are very close together, very close to the glomerulus. So we're going to zoom in to this region. And what do we have? We got, here's the afferent arteriole, here's the efferent arteriole, and then here is the distal convoluted tubule. And what's flowing through this distal convoluted tubule? Filtrate, yeah, fluid is, filtrate. And here are some cells called the macula densa cells in the distal convoluted tubule. In the interstitial area between the tubule and the arterioles, there are some more cells. These are what we call granular cells. Sometimes we call these JG cells, juxtaglomerular cells. All right, so I want you to understand the anatomy. These things right over here, I don't think we get to talk about. Maybe in anatomy you learned these to be the mesangial cells. They have some control function, but we're going to be mostly interested in the macula densa and the granular cells, and if we put this whole thing together, what do we get? We get the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, so that's some pretty important anatomy. I don't think this is an exam figure, though. Okay, that transport figure was, right, glucose and sodium going through. All right, so let's go back. Now that we see something about that autoregulation. Okay, if there's increased flow of filtrate through the distal convoluted tubule, it can be sensed by the macula densa, right? The macula densa, those are the cells of the distal convoluted tubule, part of the juxtaglomerular apparatus, right? And it can signal the afferent arterioles to constrict, all right? So if the flow, if glomerular filtration rate increases, right, there's going to be more flow of filtrate past the macula densa. The macula densa can signal the afferent arterioles to constrict, and what happens then? If the afferent arteriole constricts, less blood flow to the glomerulus, less filtrate is being produced, and what can you tell me about the flow of filtrate through the juxtaglomerular apparatus then? It goes down, right? So if there's an increase of GFR, an increase of filtrate, this mechanism right here will decrease it back to normal. Okay, but I think it was important to see something, a little bit about that anatomy. All right, so that's all I want you to know about that for right now. I think we need to go back to the proximal convoluted tubule just a little bit because we've lost, 180 liters of fluid. The proximal convoluted tubule, and you know where that is, that's just right after the glomerulus, right? The proximal convoluted tubule is working as fast as it can 100% of the time. There's no regulation. It's just going to do its job 100% of the time, maximally. All right, so what does it do? Right? It returns most water molecules from the filtrate and puts it back into the peritubular capillaries. What do we call that process? Filtrate to capillary. Yeah, it's resorption of water. All right, so about 180 liters a day of ultrafiltrate are produced. We're familiar with that, but only 1 to 2 liters of urine are excreted in any 24-hour period, which means how much water is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule? A lot, right? So like 178 liters is resorbed, otherwise we dehydrate very, very quickly. And the proximal convoluted tubule is doing that all the time without any kind of adjustment, which means then to make adjustments for your body's needs happens in the distal convoluted tubule and collecting duct. And I've mentioned that the kidney has to produce urine all the time, otherwise they're going to fail. And so there is some obligatory water loss in the body. So the kidneys have to be working. Yes, question.
So the kidney and the proximal tube, they
absorb water. I'm not sure. Oh yeah, the proximal and collecting duct, distal convoluted tubule, and even this loop of Henle here can resorb water. But most of it is taking place in the proximal convoluted tubule. If there need to be fine adjustments for water resorption, that takes place in what we call the distal tubules. Okay, so here is a pretty good diagram. I see the afferent arteriole, and I see small molecules in this nice blue color. Okay, I see some other colored molecules, green, which are way too big to be filtered, so they stay in the blood. All right, so water gets into the distal convoluted tubule. It's put back into the blood. It is resorbed. And water is resorbed passively. Okay, it follows along a concentration gradient of solutes, for instance, like sodium. So other molecules are transported across. What molecules did we see get transported across by that symporter mechanism? Glucose, for instance, and sodium get resorbed, put back in the blood. Then water follows just because of that gradient, osmotic gradient that is being produced. So water is resorbed passively. Oh, and here we talked about this already. So this is how sodium is resorbed, and then water just follows along because sodium concentration in the blood increases. And that happens in the proximal convoluted tubule. These cells are working to their maximum capacity all the time. There is really no regulation. So sodium is actively transported, and then water follows passively, and chloride follows passively as well. So the initial fluid that is filtered, right, is about two-thirds of it is resorbed within the proximal convoluted tubule. Two-thirds of all the stuff that was filtered, right, of water, sodium, and chloride can be resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. Thank goodness. Okay, so about 65% of the sodium, right, and all these other molecules are resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. That means they re-enter your body, right? And then maybe about 20% of water is resorbed in the descending loop of Henle. So we're back up to 85% of water and salt are resorbed in the proximal part of the tubules of the nephron, right? And like I said, that's constant and independent of any needs of the body. And look at the energy cost. What is driving the sodium and glucose resorption? Yeah, it is the sodium-potassium pump, right? And we use about 6% of all the calories that we consume just to make sure that the proximal convoluted tubule is operating through that sodium-potassium pump. So there is 15% that we're left with, right? 85% is resorbed, 15% can be adjusted depending on the needs of the body. And that adjustment is going to take place in the distal convoluted tubule and collecting duct, right? So this fine-tunes the amount of water that is resorbed. We're going to get to that. Collecting duct. Okay. So the collecting duct, you know where that is, plays an important role in water conservation. Permeability of water depends on the levels of antidiuretic hormone. All right, so if we have water in the filtrate and there is high antidiuretic hormone, what's going to happen to water in the filtrate inside this collecting duct? Antidiuretic hormone. It will help resorption of water from filtrate back into the blood, right, reducing the amount of urine that is produced, and hence we call that antidiuretic hormone. Let's take a look at this mechanism. Okay, so if there's low water intake, dehydration, right, the plasma osmolality increases. What's a good way of thinking of plasma osmolality increasing? More salty or less salty? Yeah, more salty, right, because we're low on water. The hypothalamus can detect that because there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. Hypothalamus is part of your brain, and it can send electrical impulses to the posterior pituitary. Anybody remember the name of that tract that goes to the posterior pituitary? Yeah, the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, right? So it goes right through the infundibulum to the posterior pituitary. And when action potentials get to the terminus of those axons, they'll release antidiuretic hormone. And that's a hormone, so it gets picked up by the blood, goes everywhere in the body, including the kidneys, but it has an effect on the kidneys because the kidneys have receptors for it, and that's going to increase water resorption. All right, so water resorption does what? Filtrate to blood. And so less water is going to be excreted in the urine. and that water is going to remain in the body. And what was the initial stimulus was low water inside the body. Okay, so water normally can't get through the collecting duct. But with antidiuretic hormone, there are special channels called aquaporins that are put into the collecting duct that allow water to move back and forth. Yeah.
So does ADH only work on the collecting duct?
Yeah, I would say that.
Okay.
Maybe I wouldn't say that exactly. Because there's another name for antidiuretic hormone, at least the effects on the kidney. Vasopressin, right? And what's the effect of vasopressin? A pressor is an agent that causes an increase in blood pressure, and it causes vasoconstriction of blood vessels, right? So, yeah, ADH has other actions. But on the kidney, you're right. Okay? Okay. All right, so here is an exam figure, but it's not in your book. And so I give this to you in your study guide, and then I've blanked out a bunch of these different labels. So this is a kind of a fabulous diagram that I wanted you guys to know. All right, so what are the compartments that we're looking at? We have filtrate, right? Filtrate, yeah, the lumen of the kidney tubule. So what would happen to stuff that's in the lumen of this kidney tubule, right where I have the cursor? What's going to happen to it? It's going to be excreted if nothing happens to it. If it stays right here, it's going to be excreted in urine, right? And then here is the wall of that tubule, the simple cuboidal epithelium. Then we have some interstitial space. Then I see it entering the blood, so this has got to be a capillary, right? So what do we got? We have a lumen of a kidney tubule. We've got the wall of the tubule, we've got an interstitial space, and then we have a capillary. And which way is something going to move if it's resorbed? Filtrate to blood, and we're interested in water. Here's water right here. Okay, so let's follow what's happening. Here we have vasopressin in the blood. And what's another name for vasopressin? Antidiuretic hormone. Vasopressin is water-soluble. I think it's a small protein. It can diffuse out of the capillary, right, because capillaries are there for exchange. It bumps into a receptor because the collecting duct has receptors for ADH. When that happens, look what happens. ATP is converted into cyclic AMP, right? And so vasopressin is outside the cell all the time. Cyclic AMP is inside the cell all the time. So what do we call vasopressin in this kind of signal transduction scheme? Vasopressin is the first messenger. Cyclic AMP is the second messenger. Right, so cyclic AMP builds up inside the cell. And here we have some endosomes. Remember for GLUT4 transporters, we looked at endosomes before. They contained, what does an endosome contain? They have, proteins that are membrane transporters. And these particular transporters are what we call aquaporins. When they're in an endosome, they're inactive, they're not performing a function. But with rising levels of cyclic AMP, these endosomes are moved over to the apical membrane of the cell and inserted into the membrane. These aquaporins allow water to move across the membrane, right? Because this membrane basically is impermeable to water because water is polar, the membrane is not polar. Okay, so we have osmolality of the filtrate. 300 milliosmolar inside the cell is 600 milliosmolar. Which one is more concentrated in solute? Inside the cell, right? There's more solute inside the cell. So there is a higher concentration of water in the filtrate than inside the cell. So what's going to happen to water? It's going to diffuse in, just simple diffusion. Okay, and we have basically the same osmolality in the interstitial fluid, right? So there's no drive of water into the interstitial space. But let's look at the osmolality of blood, in particular one kind of loop of Henle called the vasa recta. It's very salty. It's 700 milliosmolar, right? 600 milliosmolar in the cell and the interstitial space. So which way is water going to go? It's going to go from the cell into the interstitial space into the capillary. So we started in the filtrate, ended up in the capillary. We call that process, resorption of water. So this kind of mechanism is adjustable depending on the needs of the body. It's adjusted by vasopressin. It acts through the insertion of aquaporins into the apical membrane of the kidney tubule epithelium. All right, so this actually recapitulates a lot of things you learned in this chapter, in this whole course, like hydrophilic, hydrophobic compounds, how they're transported in the blood, where the receptors are. So a hydrophilic hormone, where's the receptor got to be if it's hydrophilic? It's got to be outside. It's not intracellular, it's outside. Right? And if it's outside, how does the information get transported to the inside of the cell? Through a second messenger. Exactly. Okay. And then we see the change in physiology of the cell because these proteins are inserted into the apical membrane. Okay, so I'm sure you can be really familiar with this particular slide. Sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, and next time we'll finish up this chapter.
Did we make it through all the slides up to 48 right there, or are we just kind of jumping around?
I think we're jumping around a lot.
We have a...
You have what?
Two more lectures.
Yeah, because we got an early start. I got two more lectures. I probably only have one more in real life. And then one on reproductive system. And then maybe some kind of review or something. I don't know. Okay. Maybe we can look at exam figures. Hi. Yeah, in lab.
So are you going to post that? Is that another figure?
Yeah, it's going to be two more figures.
So you're going to post it on Blackboard?
I'll post it on Blackboard and email it to you.
Okay.
Hopefully you get the email.
Okay.
But it hasn't been working for about a month or so, but maybe I think it's fixed now.
Okay.
So look in announcements.
So it'll be next Tuesday then?
Like Tuesday and Thursday, yeah. Right. So not today.
Oh, not today.
Yeah,
got
not
it.
Today. Yeah.
Hi.
Yes. Next week, Tuesday and Thursday, and then the following week, Tuesday and Thursday.
Okay.
Yeah, good. Yeah, what's happening?
So how much of chapter 20 is going to be in the content?
A couple end-of-chapter questions and one figure. I think I have a study guide for the figure in Blackboard. 20.11 maybe, or 20.33, I think. It shows all the hormone profiles during the ovulatory cycle and uterine cycle, how they go up and down.
And how they, that in
yeah, definitely.
Just like the few parts that you...
We'll go over everything on that figure.
Okay.
Yeah, everything on that figure is important.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, Corey.
When we talked about respiration, we were talking about when you go to high altitude,
okay,
how 2-3 DBG is increased.
Yeah.
First it's inhibited, then it is increased later on. And I noticed that a lot of athletes train in higher altitude, so I was wondering when they come down,
mm-hmm,
is it because the 2-3 DBG is concentrated higher in the blood?
Yeah.
First,
so they have better oxygen unloading in tissues.
Right.
I don't know how long that lasts for.
That was my next question, yeah.
I would say...
Because you said 24 hours for the process to happen, then I wonder how long for it to reverse.
I would say it would happen pretty quickly, probably another 48 hours, something like that. So if they train extensively at high altitude and then they go to Germany and perform at sea level or something, then the effect of 2-3 DPG probably will be minimal. But there are other things that happen when you train at altitude, right? So your cardiovascular system improves, your heart improves, perfusion in tissues improves.
The ventricle walls increase too.
Yeah. But I think the initial motivation was to have more oxygen delivery to tissues.
Right.
Yeah, through 2-3 DPG.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Hi. Okay.
I was just giving you the recommendation.
Oh, how nice. Thank you. What's my deadline? That's the first thing I want to know.
It's August 1st, so
okay.
You have a while.
Okay.
Okay. Just wanted to
Do you have that on here someplace?
Yeah.
Good.
And then,
okay, show me again. I want to make sure I see
it.
Oh, good. Okay.
And then for the other school that I'm applying to, I wrote it on this page, but they use an application website.
Online?
Yeah.
That's nice. That's
probably easier
easy.
For you.
Yeah, it is easier,
So I'll put your name and then they'll email you.
Okay. Okay. Oh, and this one, I will... No, I will mail it to them, or should I give this back to you?
Oh, yeah, you have to mail it to me.
Okay.
And then sign the seal.
Yeah, and then you'll put it in your application.
Yeah,
I got
pocket,
you. Okay, good.
Yeah. Thank you so
those
much.
Those are all some of the things I got to know. Good, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Calculate my grade right now as it stands to see my possibilities to go up to a B.
Yeah, let's check it out. Probably upstairs.
Okay.
Meet me by my office.
All right.
Yeah, I'll be up there real soon.